Good morning and welcome. My name is Stephanie Brandenburg, and I am a member of the Board of Trustees of this congregation, and I'm pleased to say that. We welcome all regardless of age, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religious background, or political affiliation, factors that can separate people in the larger culture. If this is your first time visiting us, please join us afterwards for refreshments. Feel free to sign our guest book, and in the front wall by the door, our brochures on UUism. People with name tags with blue dots are members of the congregation, and we'll be happy to talk with you more after services about us as well. Lastly, because services differ from week to week, we encourage you to return two or three times to get a better understanding of the variety of our worship. Now is the time to turn off your cell phones. Parents of small children are reminded that we have childcare and religious education classes, and I think they are happening today, if I'm correct. And if you choose to keep your children, please respect the need for a time for quiet and peace and reflection. We have some announcements for today. There's a date change. The fellowship forum, which was originally scheduled for April 1st, has been moved to Friday, March 18th. This will give the Board of Trustees an opportunity to hear the comments and concerns and suggestions of the congregation earlier than would be possible. So we encourage everybody to attend. There was a mass email sent out, but if you know people that don't get email, if you can kindly contact them and let them know about that change, that would be wonderful if they're not here today. Also to announce that Frost Valley Weekend Retreat is coming up April 22nd to the 24th, and you can contact Joyce DeFlumer or Patty Colombo, Nanda Land, Katie Alberti, for more information. And Sunday afternoon discussion group, if you're interested, also see Katie. Katie, want to raise your hand? There you go. Thank you. And lastly, we have a Penny Zokai to come up and speak. Penny, are you here? Yeah, there you are. She's going to talk to us about Pledge. Thank you all again and welcome.
Good morning, everybody. First off, I should thank the lovely Peg Clark for inviting me up here this morning to address you. It is a privilege, and I appreciate it. My name is Penny Zokai. I wrote this down so I wouldn't forget. I've been a member of this fellowship with my family in the back there for just over 3 years. And like some of you, unlike others of you, I allow myself the occasional sabbatical from attending services. But I'm still here and very, very proud to be associated with this fellowship. And I put some thought into this. I've come up, I so badly wanted to call them my personal ABCs, but the closest I could get were C, D, and E. My reasons for being a member here are community, downtime, and education. Although every Sunday is different in content, mood, and impact, it's the community of like-minded people, good people, people I want to get to know more, that keeps me coming back. Getting here isn't always easy for me, but I'm always happy when I do, which leads me to my second reason, the downtime. It's not the bagels I come for, but the food for thought. Not just the time for reflection and introspection, but a weekly reason. I come to nourish my soul, heal my spiritual boo-boos, and feel connected in unspoken, unseen ways. And lastly, I come for the education of myself and my family. This is perhaps the greatest gift of our fellowship, because learning about Unitarian Universalism, about the world and its many different religions, about new ideas and old habits, is what allows us to embrace differences rather than fear them, pursue challenges rather than dread them, and be good people as opposed to just ordinary people with good intentions. Everything we do in here is relevant to our lives out there. To me, that's worth far more than the price of my family's pledge. And I honestly hope that enough of you agree with me so that together we can sustain the life, the future of our fellowship. Thank you.
Our opening words today are taken from the book, The Sacred Balance, by David Suzuki. This is an excerpt quoted by Bernard Lone and Evgeny Chazov in the book A Dream, Peace, A Dream Unfolding. We must convince each generation that they are transient passengers on this planet Earth. It does not belong to them. They are not free to doom generations yet unborn. They are not at liberty to erase humanity's past, nor dim its future. At this time, I'd like to invite Mark Renser Kelly up to light our chalice and lead us in the unison affirmation.
May the light of this flame illuminate our lives and strivings of the Spirit. May it heal this understanding and strengthen love. Love is the doctrine of this fellowship.
The quest for truth is its sacrament. The service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek truth and love, to serve humanity in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony, thus to be covenant with one another.
Thank you, Mark. Now I'd like to invite everyone here to join in fellowship greeting. Please remember to keep your pivot foot planted on the ground in the spirit of March Madness. And also be aware that the next hymn is hymn number 21. Thank you. Right now, we would like to sing the children out, and then after that's completed, we'll invite anyone up to share candles of joys and sorrows for any or any other concerns that might be central in your life right now.
Candle of love from my wife, Carol, who has been warming the earth for years. Happy birthday.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Beverly Bellardi, and as a parent of our fourth coming of ager, the last and final one, I'm lighting this candle for support and joy of the kids that are sitting in the back of the room right now trying to raise money for their trip to Washington. So this candle is for the coming of agers. Thanks.
My name is Chris Harrison, and I'd like to light a candle. It was initially of joy, but I wouldn't say it's of sorrow, but it's, I guess, a little bit of slight concern over the idea of spreading myself a bit too thin at times. I'm sure, as most of you have been coming here for some time know, I've been very involved in the peace movement over the last couple of years based on my own experiences. And a few weekends ago, I attended the National Assembly for United for Peace and Justice out in St. Louis, and I had the honor of being elected to the National Steering Committee for that organization as a representative of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So I'm very honored and touched by the fact that IVAW would ask me to run on their behalf, and also that I was elected. But then after I was elected and realized how much more of a time commitment all of this is, I'm not sure how much of a joy it is at times, but I'm definitely, it's something that is very near and dear to my heart. And I'd also like to light one more candle for all of the unspoken joys and concerns that are out there among us, and may we keep them in our hearts and prayers. The first reading for today is taken from the Seven Philosophies for the Native American Man that was produced at the Gathering of Native American Men in June 1996 in Colorado. Specifically, this is the fifth philosophy, which is to the earth. Our Mother Earth is the source of all life, whether it be the plants, the two-legged, four-legged, winged ones, or human beings. The Mother Earth is the greatest teacher, if we listen, observe, and respect her. When we live in harmony with the Mother Earth, she will recycle all the things we consume and make them available to our children and their children. As an Indian man, I must teach my children how to care for the earth so it is there for future generations. So, from now on, I will honor the interconnectedness of all things and forms of life. I will realize the earth does not belong to us, but we belong to the earth. The natural law is the ultimate authority upon the lands and water. I will learn the knowledge and wisdom of the natural laws. I will pass this knowledge to my children. The Mother Earth is a living entity that maintains life. I will speak out in a good way whenever I see someone abusing the earth. Just as I would protect my own mother, so will I protect the earth. I will ensure that the land, water, and air will be intact for my children and my children's children, yet unborn. Now we will be collecting the offering.
Joseph's face was black as night. The pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked his days under Africa's skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the vein. After the dream of falling and calling your name out, these are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain. Take this child, Lord, from Tucson, Arizona. Give her the wings to fly through harmony, and she won't bother you no more. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the vein. After the dream of falling and calling your name out, these are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain. Ta boom ba boom ba boom ba boom. Ta boom ba boom ba boom ba boom. Ta boom ba boom ba boom ba boom. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere, and he walked the length of his days under African skies.
Second reading that we have for today is also taken from the Sacred Balance. This is an address that was given by the author's 12-year-old daughter to the 1992 Earth Conference in Rio de Janeiro. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in the ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back a forest where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. In my country, we make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away. Yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to lose some of our wealth, afraid to let go. You teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us. I challenge you. Please make your actions reflect your words. The next hymn will be hymn number 175, We Celebrate the Love of Life. Please stand if you're able. There is no more important resource we have as human beings than our future generations. I'm certain that all those among us who have ever had children will agree that those children were and are the primary focus of their lives. Even as someone without children of my own, I cannot help but be filled with a sense of awe and responsibility each and every time I gaze upon my niece, nephews, or even the children of friends and distant family members. As we grow into adulthood, we begin to realize that our lives are not just about our own needs and wants, but if they are to find purpose, we must also consider the needs and wants of future generations. However, with regards to another equally important resource we all share, we remain dangerously negligent. That resource is the earth, the source of all that sustains both our lives and those of our children. Just in the way that we discuss the environment, we always act as if it is something that exists outside of us as human beings, some unidentifiable other that we sometimes express an inclination to care for, but mostly just exploit for the purposes of our own temporary comfort and convenience. Because of our inability to see the earth not as something outside of ourselves, but instead to see ourselves as just one part of the greater earth, we are failing our future generations. Native American spirituality is wrapped completely around the idea of human beings being just one part of the greater environment. That is why reverence to the earth and to nature is at the center of all Native American religions. Native Americans always considered the effects of any major undertaking over the next seven generations as the highest criterion. Even though those alive at the time would be dead and long gone before that seventh generation came along, if the action would result in any kind of negative consequence toward those future progeny, it was deemed unworthy and even immoral. Conversely, the teachings of Christianity, as outlined in the book of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 26, charge man with rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Although we as Unitarian Universalists do not always like to admit it, the teachings of the Western religions, especially Christianity, lie at the center of many of the habits and preconceived notions we carry as a society to this day. Important of note in this one single verse that lies central to the traditions of both Christianity and Judaism is the way in which it explains man's relationship to the earth. Where Native Americans placed man secondary to and a much smaller part of the greater earth, Christianity and Judaism place man separate from and in dominion over all the creatures of the earth and over the earth itself. Where Native Americans perceived their role in life as the charge of stewardship over the bountiful resources of the earth, the societies that adhered to Western religions and traditions perceived themselves to be masters over the earth and its resources as something to be exploited for comfort, convenience, and the ubiquitous notion of progress. Native American activist and writer Mary Jo Moore sums up this conundrum facing modern society in her essay, Seven Generations. As evident by the title of this piece, her argument is grounded in the seventh generational principle I mentioned earlier. But there are also some thoughts within her words that speak to the principles of Unitarian Universalism as well, especially respect for the interconnected web of life of which we all are a part. She writes, "Technology is alienating us from nature. I admit I could live without electricity, and I'm positive I could survive without television. And I can write longhand. But no one can live without clean water or oxygen. Sooner or later, if the pollution and rape of our planet keeps going at the rate it has for the past 100 years, this may be a problem we have to face." A bit further along in the piece, she addresses how principles of Native American spirituality can help us overcome these problems. She says, "There is wisdom to be gleaned from American Indian cultural beliefs. A good start is understanding that we are dependent upon, not in control of, nature for our existence." Let me say that again, so it sinks in. We are dependent upon, not in control of, nature for our existence. She continues, "So many people want technology to offer quick fixes. They don't explore the mystery of spiritual interconnectedness. The true meaning of life can only be determined by realizing how everything in nature is interdependent, not by deciding what people, animals, minerals, or plants we can do without. And if we use up all our natural resources now, what will be left by the time our seventh generations arrive? I won't go into the idea of space exploration other than to say it seems a way to continue toxic waste and pollution. Perhaps tempering modern technology with spiritual wisdom should be the first thing we do before we boldly go where no man has ever gone before. Now, I will bet that many of you are asking yourselves right now, what does this have to do with global climate change? Wasn't that supposed to be the point of this service? On the surface, it would seem that our discussion to this point has had nothing to do with climate change. However, when discussing this issue in moral terms and considering its implications not only in our lives, but those of our future generations, it is important to understand the most basic context of how we view our relationship with the Earth. And as members of what is commonly referred to as Western civilization, our relationship with the Earth is one that has been founded on the idea of exploitation of its resources for our own short-term gain, with little or no concern for the long-term implications of our actions. While we often cite the gains of science and technology as justification for the way we use and abuse our planet, the truth of the matter is that it will be our progeny, that seventh generation, that will be left to deal with the mess we made due to our collective and individual carelessness and selfishness. I do not want anyone here to think that because of my urgent tone, I consider myself to somehow be above and exempt from examining how my life comes into play. Quite the contrary. I live a lifestyle that is destructive to the earth, and much of it is due to my own choosing. As a participant in what is known as the American way of life, I engage willingly in a lifestyle that is degrading the air, water, and soil we all depend upon for survival. And I am also a major contributor to the phenomenon known as global climate change. But what exactly is global climate change? Is it something we should look forward to, an end to cold and icy winters throughout the northern United States and Canada, offering us all a chance to catch up on our suntans throughout the year? Is it some kind of Chicken Little scheme hoisted on us by a bunch of alarmist scientists and fringe environmentalists? Is it something happening as we speak? Or do we have decades to come up with new technologies to address it? As an answer to these questions, I'll share a couple of excerpts from a report published last year by that hotbed of left-wing activism and radical environmentalism, the Pentagon. The report states, and I quote, "Disruption and conflict will be endemic features of life. Once again, warfare would define human life," end quote. The report's authors, Pete Schwartz and Doug Randall, in an interview with the British publication The Observer, stated, "Already the planet is carrying a higher population than it can sustain. By 2020, catastrophic shortages of water and energy supply will be increasingly difficult to overcome, plunging the planet into war." Another more recent article in the Guardian Independent of Great Britain profiled a subsequent report that warned that we may reach the point of no return in global climate change within the next 10 years. The report's authors concluded that we could see widespread agricultural failure, water shortages and major droughts, increased disease, sea level rise, and the death of forests, with the added possibility of abrupt catastrophic events such as runaway global warming, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, the switching off of the Gulf Stream. This report was not created by a left-wing think tank, nor an environmentalist organization. It was chaired by Stephen Byers, former Transportation Secretary for the UK, and U.S. Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican from Maine. What does all of this mean? It means that in spite of our intentions to leave our future generations with a better life than what we had, we may, in fact, be leaving them with a hard and brutish future due to our own negligence and wastefulness. It means that if we continue to ignore the scientific evidence of the imminence and possible severity of global climate change, then we are willingly leading lives that are destructive to our children, grandchildren, and their children and grandchildren's future. In short, it means that we are living a destructive lifestyle that is morally inexcusable and indefensible in every sense of the word, especially in the eyes of our future generations. Before you begin to feel hopeless or even angered at this grim scenario, it is important to point out that the future is not set in stone. It is still what we decide to make it. There may be instances in which the wheels of climate change have already been set in motion and cannot be stopped. We will have to deal with those phenomena, both individually and collectively, as they arise. But there are many more effects of it that we have the capacity to slow or even prevent them from occurring. It is a moral imperative that we seize the opportunity to do so before it is too late. The first step is just recognizing the reality of climate change and our contribution to it. The American media often portrays climate change as a possibility as opposed to a certainty. Our political system certainly engages in spreading doubt over its reality, especially those politicians who are heavily backed by fossil fuel industries. The picture in Europe and the rest of the industrialized world, however, is quite different. There, the question is not whether or not climate change exists, but rather how bad its effects will be. Politicians, rather than denying its existence, discuss national and international strategies to address its effects. While industry-funded scientists who disclaim the existence of human-induced climate change are given credence in America, the rest of the world chooses to listen to the 95% of climate scientists who agree it does exist and is getting worse. We need to listen to that 95%, what could only be described as a consensus, and spread their warnings to all our friends and family. We need to begin to take concrete steps to change our daily lives in ways both large and small to reduce our contribution to climate change. In his book, Boiling Point, based on the opinions of many leading scientists, author Ross Gelbspan cites the need for a 70% reduction in our carbon emissions in order to successfully arrest climate change. While such a figure seems rather impossible right now, it is still imperative that we at least begin to work toward it. It has been said that the longest journey begins with a single step, and such is the attitude with which we must approach this problem. There are countless steps we can take right now to begin this journey. When I travel throughout the New York metropolitan area, it is apparent that fuel efficiency and carbon-based emissions are not primary concerns for most people when purchasing an automobile. In fact, many appear to purposely seek out the least fuel-efficient vehicles in a quest for display of status. And many others will purchase oversized sports utility vehicles out of the justification that they are somehow safer for their kids in the event of an accident. But considering the fact that automobiles are a primary producer of the polluting carbon gases that cause climate change, accompanied by the fact that oil is a finite resource that should be conserved, does it not make sense that fuel efficiency should be a major consideration when purchasing an automobile? For those of us who sacrifice fuel efficiency out of a desire for status or a feeling of safety while driving, we are actually mortgaging the lives of our future generations in order to grasp a fleeting sense of false security or just to enhance our self-esteem. Therefore, it is important that we consistently seek out the most fuel-efficient vehicle that meets our real, not perceived, transportation needs. While on the subject of automobiles, how many of us regularly use our cars and trucks for trips that we could make by other means? How often do we choose to run our errands on a nice day by foot or bicycle? as opposed to by automobile? How often do we travel by car rather than public transit because of simple convenience? I myself live in a town and do try to walk or bike whenever possible, but I still find countless instances in which I make short trips by car that I could have walked or biked instead. I try to take advantage of public transit whenever possible, but still avoid taking the train at times that it becomes slightly inconvenient. If each of us consciously evaluated our transportation choices in this manner and made our decisions with ecological considerations at the forefront, then we could collectively make a considerable difference through our individual actions. And we might even help provide a push for better alternative transportation networks in the process. When we seek to buy a home, do we do so with ecological considerations in mind? Do we seek out a house that is just large enough to meet our needs? Or do we instead purchase one with considerably more space than we actually require? Do we take into account the energy needed to heat and cool our homes? Not to mention power all the appliances that we have come to see as necessities rather than conveniences. Do we choose a site for our home that avails us to the possibility of walking, biking, or taking public transit for a majority of our transportation needs? Or do we instead choose to live in the country where we have to drive nearly everywhere we want to go? It is important that we consider all of these criteria because they all have significant implications for our contributions to climate change, and making the right choices can vastly reduce that contribution. After all, what good does it do our children to grow up in oversized homes on country roads with all the latest fads in home appliances and entertainment if the eventual cost is a life much more short and brutish than that to which we have become accustomed? What we eat even has a good deal of influence toward climate change. When we purchase industrially produced agriculture or processed foods in the supermarket, or insist on eating fruits and vegetables that are out of season, we are contributing towards climate change. After all, industrialized agricultural practices are heavily dependent on mechanized equipment and chemical fertilizers, and it takes a great deal of oil to transport massive quantities of fruit and vegetables to northern climates. Processed foods up the ante even more through the additional energy that is expended to manufacture them after the harvest. We can help alleviate these effects by purchasing as much locally grown organic produce that is in season as possible. And if we're overly ambitious, we can even grow some of our food ourselves. Having been raised in a household where gardening was more a way of life than a hobby, I can attest that it can be extremely self-fulfilling in addition to an earth-friendly activity. Do we find ourselves seeking contentment in what we all have? Or is life for us a relentless pursuit of more? More money, more gadgets and gizmos, more and newer household appliances, more and bigger cars, and so on. Each item that we purchase takes energy to extract the raw materials and also to manufacture. Therefore, each time we are purchasing things that we don't need simply because we've allowed ourselves to be convinced that we do need them, we are contributing a bit more to climate change. Also, we often sacrifice in the quality of our lives in order to raise our standard of living. We work more hours at jobs we don't like in order to buy more things for the families we don't get to spend enough time with. It's a vicious cycle. However, if we can learn to lose the idea of more, bigger, better, and replace it with the alternative concept of enough, we might not only find that we are living a life that leaves less of an ecological footprint on the earth, but one that gives us a great deal more fulfillment by allowing us to cultivate the familial and human relationships that give our lives meaning. Rather than seeking entertainment through television or some activity that involves spending money, we can learn to find it in the grandeur of nature, the heaven beneath our feet, of which Catherine Ward spoke of just a month or so ago. Living simply does not mean living less. It means living more fully by finding contentment in the things you already have. And since none of us in this congregation could be considered to be even close to going without the basic necessities of life, it brings to mind another saying, live simply so that others may simply live. By learning the meaning of enough, we can help create a world in which those who have never had enough will be able to achieve that threshold, and in a way that gives respect to the earth that we all share together. But while individual actions are important in forming a better world and staving off the worst effects of climate change, they are not enough. Truly addressing this problem means that we have to become involved in the collective sphere as well. We need to educate our friends, neighbors, and family members. We need to organize in order to agitate our elected officials and media outlets for change. And should they refuse to address these problems and continue to hide their heads in the sand, we need to work to remove those politicians from office, even if it means running for elected office ourselves. The means are certainly there right now for us to deal effectively with climate change. All that is missing is the political will. It is up to all of us, acting collectively, to create that political will. Global climate change is real. It is happening, and its effects could range from detrimental to catastrophic. The vast majority of the scientific community is in consensus on this. However, like anything else, the future is not set in stone. Previous generations may have helped contribute to these changes, but it does no good to hold them accountable because they were not fully aware of the effects of their actions. Unlike them, we do not have the luxury of pleading ignorance. For us, it is a matter of embracing reality and acting on it. Or to deny it and pretend it does not exist, at severe consequences to our future generations and even to ourselves. The choice is ours. However, it will be up to future generations to look back upon this time as one in which humankind rose to the challenge of significantly changing itself and its relationship with the earth for the better. Or if we instead continued to dither out of selfishness and laziness, and in so doing condemn them to a new dark age. I would much rather that this time be viewed as one of renewed hope and not catastrophic failure, but the ultimate responsibility as to how this time is judged now rests with all of us. For those of you that are interested in concrete, specific actions that you can take on an individual basis to help address this in your daily lives, I've made copies of a flyer that was put out by Environmental Defense on 20 simple steps that you can do to reduce climate change. If you didn't grab them on the way in, they're out on the front counter with the orders of service. Thank you. At this time, I'd like to open up the floor to anyone's thoughts, questions, comments, sharing, or whatever.
It's amazing how sometimes there really is a lot of synergy. First of all, thank you so much for your sermon. It was really very inspiring. I knew that climate change was real about 10, 15 years ago when I started reading about it in the copies of Chemical and Engineering News that my husband left around the house. The American Chemical Society is not made up of rabid environmentalists, and they were talking rather rationally about, you know, the effect of too much, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I knew that was real. The other interesting synergy is This week I started working on my first non-healthcare project in 16 years. Another project manager was too busy. I'm an architect. And so I kind of jumped into this in the middle, and it's for the Department of Environment, Ecology, and Evolutionary Studies, I think, Evolutionary Biology at Columbia University. And I didn't know what they did. I was sitting there waiting for the meeting to start with the principal investigator, and I said, well, what do you guys actually do? He said, well, ecologists, people who love animals, have learned that you don't no longer have this luxury of studying animals apart from humans. What we try to do is find the species that are about to go extinct and study them. He said, even in the bottoms of the ocean, the plankton is changing. And so he has a program where he's training biologists not only to study evolutionary change and species extinctions, but take on a advocacy position with policymakers, which I thought was really an exciting idea, and it really is a hopeful sign. The other coincidence is I think this is the week when the administration is trying to slip into the budget bill the authorization to drill in the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, which is the full name for this little thing called ANWR. So it's all around us.
I'm Tom Levine. I have a couple of questions. I see in the newspaper periodically references to the Kyoto Treaty or agreement, I think. And my question is, what is it? Will it promote reduction of the climate change, and if so, why is the administration opposed to it?
Are you asking that as a
question?
Okay. Basically, the Kyoto Treaty was a treaty that came out of the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, and was actually promoted by the first President Bush as a measure to address climate change. It was not ratified by the Senate all throughout the Clinton presidency, and then one of the first acts of the Bush administration was to announce that they would not be signing on to it because they cited that it would be too detrimental to the American economy, which, in my opinion, is an extremely short-sighted way of looking at things, because as the realities of climate change come into view, it's going to make the American economy basically non-existent. It's going to it really could almost throw us back, if we don't take steps to come up with alternative forms of energy, could throw us back into the days of pre-industrial revolution, quite frankly, where we would no longer have the types of energy that gives us the very things that we take for granted, like with lighting, with heating, and things in our basic transportation structures. Why the administration is not signing on to it, I think it just goes with a basic ideology that they have expressed from the beginning. It's kind of this strange coming together of Christian fundamentalism that expresses a view of former Reagan Interior Secretary James Watt, who announced publicly in a meeting when asked about his policies, after the last tree is felled, Christ will return to the earth. And also with the business interests of the fossil fuel industry and the auto industry also, with they don't want to crimp any of their profits, and that they really see, you know, the trade-off as being worth it in the short run for them.
The greatest sin, in fact, the only sin, is the extinction of the human race. That's what you're really talking about.
Not really.
You're talking about preventing the extinction of the human race. But those things that we do which lead to the possibility of the extinction of the human race is the only sin. I'm taking the position of making that as a statement. Okay. But right over your head is something that I often talk about in my classes. That is, we live on the earth, and we think of the earth as pretty big, like that earth symbol over your head. But we don't live in the earth. We just live on the surface of the earth. We live in an environment which is smaller than the ring around that circle. So the environment we live in and always have lived in, we're created in, and will only survive in, is not very big.
You know, what really amazes me is that the stuff that you're talking about today was being talked about over 30 years ago when I was in high school and college. And, you know, the same exact things were being said. I mean, we were getting handouts like this when I was in college, and we really tried to live by these tenets. That was during the energy crisis of the 70s, and everybody, you know, got on the bandwagon and you know, bought small cars and rode bicycles and stuff like that, and, you know, tried to live with only one car in the family. And then all of a sudden in the 80s, this just sort of disappeared. And it seems to be coming back now that, you know, that gas prices have reached crisis proportions again. But it's like, where were we for the last 20 years? The thing that amazes me as I'm a psychiatrist, the American mind is so capable of self-delusion and denial and fantasy. It seems like one of the main exports and one of the main industries of this society now, of American industry, is fantasy, like movies, DVDs, CDs, fantasy neighborhoods, you know, that Disney-fied Times Square and stuff like that. I mean, it's like television. It's like I think we're kind of sinking more and more into a fantasy world. You know, the people driving around in SUVs, I mean, like, I saw a commercial not too long ago where they said, you know, it gives you a feeling of safety. It's like, yeah, because 9/11 happened, we all have to have bigger cars so we can feel safe. And it's like, they're actually not as safe as smaller cars because they tend to roll over and stuff. So it's just, it never ceases to amaze me how, you know, we can hide our heads in the sand so easily. And it's, you know, and even those of us who were involved in this stuff back in the 70s.
Hi, I'm Phil Sears, and I guess this is sort of a report from the field. I've been doing environmental planning and overseeing projects for, well, going back to when my hair was brown. And for the past couple of years, I've been working with the Long Island Power Authority and overseeing power of the environmental planning of power projects. And I'm going to talk about three, but I think you'd be happy to know that we, on all of those projects, do a carbon analysis, do a effect on climate change, even though there is no requirement for that. The attorneys that we work with, you know, say that this is what really needs to be done so we can really understand what is going on. But on one project, and I happen to be on the selection committee, we had to take, there was some problem areas, and where we had to have power over here and power over there to prevent blackouts. And we got all of the proposals in, and what was the one cheapest by far was what we call these little belchers, these little diesels that put out 2 megawatts, and you can put them here, you can put them there. We went through all sorts of add-ons and this and that and traps, and we finally got them so they can barely make it. And but we had to choose them because that was by far the best for the ratepayer. Luckily, it's only a 4-year project. They did not have to be used last year, but they could be this coming summer. And the driver on the selection of them was, what is the impact on the ratepayer? And that is something you have to always think about, because that is one of the criteria that have been set for us to make selections. We are doing two other projects. One is it's supposed to be for 08. We're hoping that it'll actually be 09. It's a 350 megawatt plant, and it's natural gas. Yes, we could do better, but we're pushing that one forward. And I don't even feel too bad about that, because we can take this plant, run this. It has much less CO2 output, and take perhaps one of the other baseload plants off at various times and drop the output. And the third one, which we would hope to have going in 2012, is the offshore wind. And this is one of the ones that you sort of look forward to and say, this is good. I did take issue with one of the quotes earlier, that technology is separating us from nature, and I'm going, we have to understand the technologies and develop them so that we can use these ways to go forward. Now, is this offshore wind going to go forward? Well, one of those little mundane things that nobody ever thinks about has come up. The price of fabricated steel has just gone sky high. You know, it's just going up and up, and all of a sudden, it looks like proponent is going to have to up the cost, and then that's going to change the effect on the rate payers. And so this one right now may or may not go. You know, it's very hard to tell. And where this is leading me as the final conclusion is that we make a lot of these decisions in actually doing these things based upon our near-term cost. And there's a very real social reason for that. But things are slowly changing where our natural resources damage assessment is now being accepted as a real tool. And we are starting to put more and more emphasis onto the cost of the environment, you know, that I'm put on to selection committees because I'm speaking from the environmental side and how is this going to affect it environmentally. 10 years ago, they would not have had an environmental planner on the selection committee.
Thank you. We'll take one more.
Thank you. What I find most powerful is the idea of enough. And I think one of the real problems we have as human beings is that I know myself, and certainly what I think I see around me, is that we don't really have an internal mechanism for enough. There's no way we regulate that. We don't know what enough is. I don't know what enough is. I don't see us knowing what enough is. And that, I think, is part of the psychological dilemma that we have in dealing with this problem.
Thank you, everyone, for your input, and thank you, Chris.
We have one more hymn today. It's hymn number 19, The Sun That Shines. Thank you.
I'd just like to mention, for the benediction, please refrain from the go now in peace. There will be a separate benediction given at the end. And now please join me in saying for the chalice extinguishing, carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again. The natural world is subject as well as object. The material world is the material source of our being as earthlings and life-giving nourishment of our physical, emotional, aesthetic, moral, and religious existence. The natural world is the larger sacred community to which we all belong. To be alienated from this community is to become destitute in all that makes us human. To damage this community is to diminish our own existence. For those of you that are visiting for the first time, we also have a coffee hour immediately following, which is right now. And for those of you, once again, I want to reiterate about the sheets from Environmental Defense. They're out on the front counter. And if they run out and you need one, let me know, and I'll run off some more copies of it. Thank you.